I want to actually pick up on something that you mentioned in that interview, which is that 1969 kind of seems like the lens through which Tarantino's career was shot. Mm. And, you know, Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio both discussed it in the interview. But this was a big tipping point for Hollywood, right? Because you had in the 60s, the industry was obsessed with historical epics, these kind of spoofy comedies, musicals, the TV westerns, of course, through which Leonardo DiCaprio's character Rick Dalton had become famous in the first place. You've got all that going on. And of course, post 69, you went into Hollywood's very dark, introspective, paranoid period. And of course, you know, directors like Peckinpah come out. And so Tarantino was kind of drawing from both sides of this historical split. And the point at which Hollywood split, and this was identified by a writer called Joan Didion in this sort of seminal essay called The White Album, which she wrote about the Tate murders and the Manson family and all the strange cultural forces that were coming to bear on Hollywood at that point. Basically, the death of Sharon Tate at the hands of the Manson family and her friends in the house as well was the point at which the entire film industry zigzagged off in a completely different direction. It had lost before then the interest of young moviegoers who were mainly interested in music at that point, which seemed much more progressive and experimental. Of course, Easy Rider was the alternate kind of the John the Baptist movie for the era that was to come. So I think understanding the sense that this is happening at this historical tipping point is absolutely crucial. Because, you know, you spoke about as well in the interview, the sense that the film is full of downtime. There are people killing time on set. There's this fantastic sequence where Brad's character, Cliff Booth, is killing time backstage with Bruce Lee. And he, because everyone's bored and everyone is basically frittering away the day until their next going to be useful, the two of them get into this fight. I mean, for no reason whatsoever. But there's this sense that time is kind of, for, you know, endless. And we've got as much of this as we can do with, you know, more than we really know what to do with. We're going to just poodle around town in cars. We're going to go and see ourselves in the cinema, watch one of our own movies. The pivotal scene, I think, of the entire film, which I'll come back to, is Margot Robbie, Sharon Tate, going to this cinema in Westwood and watching The Wrecking Crew, which was this spoof spy movie that she was in with Dean Martin. Just because she's got a spare afternoon, she's going to go and watch herself to see how the film turned out. So at the same time as everyone's killing time, and as if this is an idyll that's going to last forever, there's also the sense that, you know, Rick is kind of aware in the back of his head that his expiry date is approaching. You know, he's no longer as nimble on set as he would like. We see him filming a cowboy TV show where he's appearing as a guest star, a guest villain, and he can't remember his lines. He's calling out for lines. Then he has to go and psych himself up in his trailer as this, you know, incredibly funny but also incredibly tragic scene where he realises that he's no longer the young promising star that he once was. In fact, we learn that he took a swing at a film career which kind of fell flat. He gave up a very good TV series called Bounty Law in order to do that. So he's being washed up slightly before his time. And then there's also what we know about the era is that the Tate murders are approaching. You know, this is set 6 months before those murders happen. So it's set mostly in February 1969, but then it flashes forward to August of 1969 for its final act. And we know these people are hurtling towards a reckoning. The whole town is hurtling towards a reckoning, but they kind of don't. They're not aware of it. And that's what the kind of core tension of this movie is. And the reason that it really sort of wrung me out from the inside is that you're watching time being killed when there is not enough time to kill. And, you know, something that Joan Didion wrote in The White Album is that when these murders happened, one of the worst things about it was that nobody was surprised. There was a sense in the air that we have to somehow work out why this happened. We have to tell stories. I think the other line from the essay is that we have to tell ourselves stories in order to live. We have to work out why these things happen through narrative and through, you know, the kind of thing, in fact, that Tarantino's doing in this film, you know, going back, looking at what led to what, and, you know, A led to B led to C, and that's how we ended up where we ended up. And that's what this film is absolutely all about. It's about kind of making sense of this twilight of this golden era and working out where it was that history suddenly split and things went zigzagging off in another direction. It reminded me an enormous amount of Hal Ashby's Shampoo, which was a film that came out in 1975, that reflected on the night of the eve of the Nixon election. In fact, the whole film was set on that day before Nixon was elected. Starring Warren Beatty as a hairdresser who was, I think, partly inspired by Jay Sebring, who is one of the people who was murdered in the Cielo Drive house, along with Sharon Tate, by the Manson family. And in that film, you have various stylish Hollywood gadabouts zipping around, running errands. Warren Beatty spends an enormous amount of that film on a very fancy motorcycle racing between clients to, you know, zhuzh up this person's hair in time for a party, then go around and romance some, well, another client, you know, he goes to chat up Carrie Fisher for a while, who very much reciprocates. And there's, because it's, the film has been made from the from a historical, you know, from a historical perspective, we're looking back on these events. You're watching these people killing time, and you're watching them thinking, you know, this ultimately doesn't matter. That's the core tension there. And I'm sure that that film must have heavily, heavily inspired Tarantino when he came to make this as well. As well, you notice that in a lot of sequences, there's so much driving in this film. People just driving around Los Angeles with purpose, without purpose. Tarantino frequently puts the camera in the back of the car. And there's this sense that you're stuck in the car with no say over the destination. It's taking you somewhere. And all you can do is bear with it, look out the window, see what's flying past the window, and enjoy the ride as best you can. I mean, I think the core of the film is obviously the Rick Dalton-Cliff Booth friendship. I think the chemistry between the two, between DiCaprio and Pitt is fantastic. I think DiCaprio's performance reminded me a lot of early Jack Nicholson. In fact, in Easy Rider, the character that Nicholson plays in that, the lawyer who just takes up on this crazy hippie bike ride for, you know, just on a whim. There's that sense of tragedy and fallibility, but also this kind of lightning spark craziness to it as well, that is just below the surface. DiCaprio does that absolutely. And I think Pitt is enormously reminiscent of Robert Redford in this, and particularly from the fact that he often just doesn't do very much at all. There's a fantastic scene where he climbs up onto Rick's roof to fix an aerial. And there's just a kind of a bliss in watching him go about his work without worrying about, you know, what's around the corner. There's another terrific sequence where he drives home to this caravan, which is kind of perched between this oil derrick and a drive-in cinema, which is basically Tarantino saying, like, in geographic terms, this is all you need to know about this guy. He's behind the screen, and he's also beside this enormous metal clanking arm that's going up and down all night. And he just goes into his caravan. He feeds his pet dog some horrible-looking dog food. I think it's raccoon flavour or rat flavour or a cocktail of the two. And then he makes himself instant macaroni cheese. And there's just a pleasure in spending time with these people and acclimatizing to this world that has been done, I think, better in this film than any that really spring to mind, probably, that were shot in Los Angeles since Shampoo, you know, since the mid-70s, when that aesthetic and that era could be much more easily evoked. I was totally enraptured by this. I have to say, at this point, I've seen it a couple of times. I think it may be Tarantino's late career masterpiece. It just totally swept me along. And I think, as I said, there's this pivotal scene where Margot Robbie's Sharon Tate goes to watch herself in the cinema. And what's crucial about this is she's not famous yet. To understand who Sharon Tate was, you have to understand that she was groomed for a kind of stardom that was actually no longer really in existence by the time she got there. She was headhunted as someone beautiful and glamorous, who could be shaped through comportment classes and through posture and acting classes. She did studied method for a while in New York by this manager, who very much wanted to turn her into a new golden age screen siren. But by the time she was ready to be unveiled to the world, it was the middle of the 1960s, and the kind of films those sirens made in the, you know, 30s and 40s were no longer particularly cool. The first film that she was released that she was in was this slightly scrappy sex comedy called Don't Make Waves, which is Alexander McKendrick's last film. And it was just deeply uninspiring and felt like a kind of a squandering of that kind of stardom. So this career that she's been prepared for, groomed for years, has not fully taken flight, but she goes in to watch herself in this film at the cinema, incognito. You know, she introduces herself very sweetly at the ticket booth, but then slips in unnoticed. And she's able to hear the people around her laughing and applauding and enjoying her performance. They don't know she's there to register that enjoyment, but she is. And it's a way of saying, you know, look, let's kind of give time to these people who were not megastars of the day. Sharon Tate's films, you know, I would not urge anyone to seek them out for any reason beyond seeing her work. They're not great films. But to have her given that moment in the cinema to soak up the applause that she deserved, and these bit parters like Rick and Cliff, I think is incredibly moving. And so when this horrific final moment comes, which I think we can talk a bit about more after the news, because it's worth according more time to, but that sense of how moving that is, that's been lost, and you're made to feel that loss, is extraordinarily powerful.
Before the news, you were talking about that sequence where Sharon Tate goes to watch herself in the Wrecking Crew.
Yep.
In the cinema. And I kind of, you know, I have read some comments about how self-indulgent that seemed. But I have to say, you know, of many of the scenes in the film, I thought it was a really lovely scene. And actually, I remember the first time I had my name on a kind of, you know, on a billboard or kind of, you know, outside a theatre or something. And it's a really extraordinary feeling. And I was thinking about this. I think the first film that I actually went to see with a cinema, with a paying audience, was actually Paddington 2. And that's because my kids wanted to see it, and I took them along to see it. And I think that had I been younger, had I started, you know, younger, and if I'd been sort of, you know, in my early 20s, mm-hmm. that moment of magic of kind of seeing myself on a screen, knowing, not enjoying the fact that I was watching myself, but suddenly realizing you're part of this world.
Yeah.
That you dreamt with. I thought that was, that for me, that really came across in that scene.
You could have had your shoes off.
I wouldn't have had my shoes off. I mean, that's definitely a code violation, isn't it?
I mean, there are some serious code violations in this film. But yeah, I mean, this is the idea. You know, when you go to the cinema, there's this understanding that the actors, the director, are not actually present to receive any reaction. So the reaction is totally unbidden. It's completely natural and it's freely given. And I think that's what's so beautiful about that sequence, is that she's enjoying seeing people enjoy her. She's enjoying the sensation of other people enjoying her work, and they don't even know she's there to receive it. Now, this totally plays into what you were saying about this Once Upon a Time in the title. I saw Once Upon a Time and thought, this is Tarantino, basically, he's going to be doing Sergio Leone, you know, big foundational myths of the American dream, the American way of business, you know, like Once Upon a Time in the West or Once Upon a Time in America. It's not. It's the Once Upon a Time in this is the fairy tale Once Upon a Time. And so many fairy tales are bound up in ideas about grief and regret. You know, Sleeping Beauty, she's flat on her back, basically. You know, we wish someone could just come along, kiss her, and she'd get up and it would all be okay. Snow White, you know, as well, the idea of the poisoned apple, how can she be brought back from this? And so much of what Tarantino is doing in this is kind of trafficking in this fairy tale mood to give Sharon Tate, and also characters like Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton, and these bit parters in the industry, the unsung heroes, their chance to shine. And it's not in the spotlight, it's just to be able to be recognised as having contributed something worthwhile, even if it is fluff, you know, even if it is this ultimately fairly daft Western TV series. There's this extraordinary sequence. One thing we've not really spoken about yet is the actual role of the Manson family in this, who are, of course, they are the historical reckoning that's waiting at the end of the film. And there's this incredible sequence where DiCaprio's character is guest starring as a villain on this TV show, and he's by turn doing badly and doing extremely well. And you can sense this, you know, he realises his career is really at some kind of tipping point. And it's very, very precarious whether he's going to deliver a scene beautifully or not. Simultaneously, Brad Pitt's character, the stunt double, is out basically enacting a Western for real, in the way that stunt doubles, of course, they have to take the punches and the falls for their stars, out on the Spahn Ranch, which is this old Western TV set outside of Los Angeles, where the Manson family did really congregate. That was their base of operations. He goes out there and Tarantino shoots this incredibly tense encounter, like it's a spaghetti Western, like the thing that his boss, his friend, I think he's described as more than a friend, but a little less than a wife, is going through currently on set for Pretend. This is simultaneously being enacted for real. Now, what I would say about the Manson sequence at the end, and of course, like you, I had my heart in my throat as it approached. And I think even in a career that is full of fairly terrifying, violent sequences, this is the hardest of those sequences, I think, to watch. The first time around, I was genuinely shocked by it. I had to shield my eyes at some moments, and there was there's one particular section of it where I even said out loud, oh no, you know, because you're aware what's going to happen. But both times I've watched it, I've gone with it. Actually, the second time I watched it, I was much more moved by it. I was actually moved to tears by what it was showing had been lost, and you know, on that night. But you can feel the audience, or certainly I felt the audience at both screenings. It's like this kind of enormous cosmic zip in the middle of the cinema is just going whoop, and half of the audience go with it and half of them don't. And there are very strong persuasive arguments on both sides, I think, for why that sequence is ultimately it does deserve to have been made and deserves to be there, and is, you know, in the way that I found it, yes, intensely shocking and horrible, but also deeply moving. And also those who would argue that it's exploitative, because it's basically, you know, it's taking a real life horrible tragedy and filmifying it in a very, 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 very Tarantino-like way.
Mm.
So I am extraordinarily excited to see what people make of this film. I think, you know, regardless of what you make of it, it's a film that forces you to confront your own reactions to it and reckon with them. And as I say, this is, after having seen it twice, the first time it was at the Cannes press screening, which was back in May. So I've had a long time to sit on this and chew it over. As I say, I do think, for me, it's at least top three of his, up with Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, and late career masterpiece status kind of feels about right.